She took the skis under her arm and brought them back to the kitchen. The soup was ready, and she poured it into a bowl, devouring it in seconds. It seemed only to awaken her hunger. She made herself another, promising that she would replace it when she went to Freiburg. The second can of soup did the job, but the sweat-stained filth clinging to her body remained. The thought of heating on the stove all the water she would need almost seemed too much. But the sheer smell she must have emanated was motivation enough. She put the kettle and two large saucepans of water on the stove and sat, watching as they came to boiling point. The awareness of a strange, albeit immobilized and unconscious man in the house was with her as she closed the door to change. Emerging in her bathrobe, she paced to the bathroom, shutting the door behind her. The candlelight lent the room an air of relaxation, but the lack of water did not. The wonderful bath she'd been dreaming of ended up being a case of sitting in the tub and scrubbing herself down. The coldness of the cabin hit her as she emerged, dripping from the bath. She grabbed a towel and rubbed herself as hard as she could, using the friction to warm herself. Once she was dried and in her bathrobe, she went to the mirror. She hadn't looked at herself in days. Her shoulder-length blonde hair lay straggly, stuck to her neck. Her blue eyes were bloodshot, and large, darkened circles hung underneath them. She ran a comb through her hair, wincing in pain as the knots came out. She thought about Herr Birkel and remembered his son, the charming Hitler youth she'd fallen for during her time in the League of German Girls, the female equivalent of the Hitler Youth. Everyone she knew joined. It became a rite of passage. To not join would have singled out a young boy or girl as a weakling, an upstart, or a malingerer, perhaps even a pariah. A wave of paranoia hit her. How did she know Birkel hadn't seen them? Maybe he had seen them, and had already reported them to the Gestapo. It seemed unlikely, but there was no room for error when no one could be trusted. Night had settled, and she lit candles in the kitchen and the bedroom, as well as the oil lamp in the living room. The man was still asleep when she peeked in on him. She went to her bedroom again, and though her body yearned for sleep, she couldn't let herself, not yet. She got dressed once more. The Gestapo could come at any time. He was exposed. Hiding him in the closet would only prolong by seconds the amount of time it would take to find him, and he was too injured to hide outside in the cold of winter. Running through nightmarish scenarios in her mind, each of them realistic, she went back into the bedroom where he lay asleep. They weren't safe, even up here, particularly if she had to go into town. The Luftwaffe uniform was still bundled up in the corner where she'd thrown it. If, on the off chance, he was Luftwaffe, she could give it back to him. In the much more likely scenario that he was British or American, it would only serve to have him shot as a spy. It had to be hidden, but where? She stomped her foot and heard the hollow wooden sound from the floorboards. She got the toolbox from the kitchen, went to the bedroom where he was sleeping, and pulled up a thin rug, exposing the wooden slats below. If she pried up the boards, she could create an effective hiding place, but first she would have to move the bed. She made her way over to the side of the bed and pushed it across the room, the man still asleep on it. She dug the claw of a hammer into the space at the end of the long floorboard, then angled it back, wrenching it upward. After a few minutes of wrestling with it, the stubborn board gave way. She finished the job with gloved hands and placed the board against the wall, revealing a 2-foot space below. It was filthy and freezing cold, but would do the job nicely with a bit of cleaning and a few blankets. She set to work on the adjoining floorboard, wondering how many she would have to pry up to fit him in the space. The fewer, the better. Everything had to look as natural as possible. A cough from the bed jarred her from her concentration, and the hammer fell out of her hand into the hole she'd created. She stood up as the man's eyes flew open. He sat up in the bed, his face contorted into a horrible grimace. He clamped his eyes shut before opening them again and turned to where she, stunned silent, was standing. Pain and confusion clouded his eyes. "Who are you? Why are you keeping me here?" he said in perfect German. Chapter 4. His accent was hard to place. She'd known Berliners before, had heard their slender, harsh accents. He had some of the hallmarks of that, but it seemed there was something missing. It was hard to explain, almost like trying to describe a dance to a blind person. He was sitting up on the bed, his eyes imploring. It had been several seconds since he'd asked her, and his words were still hanging like smoke in the air. A thousand thoughts flashed through her mind, but she wasn't quite able to catch hold of any of them. She stepped forward, her arms outstretched, her hands turned upward, as if in a gesture of defense.
"I am a friend," she said.
He didn't reply, seemingly wanting more.
"I found you in the snow. You were unconscious. The pain you feel is the fractures you sustained in both of your legs."
The man ran his hands along the splint sheet fashion from the kitchen chair, and the grimace came again.
"My name is Franka Gerber. I brought you back here. It's just the two of us. The nearest village is several miles away."
"Where are we?"
"We're about 10 miles east of Freiburg, in the mountains of the Black Forest."
The man brought a hand to his forehead. He seemed to recover from his confused state and spoke with some clarity now. "You are with the police?" he asked.
"No, I'm not."
"Do you have any affiliation with the Gestapo or the security forces?"
"No, I don't. I have no phone. I found you and brought you back here."
The words tumbled out of her mouth. Her hands were shaking by her side. She brought them behind her back. The man narrowed his eyes before speaking again. "My name is Hauptmann Werner Graf of the Luftwaffe."
"I saw your uniform."
"Why did you take me back here?"
"I found you last night. We were too far from anywhere that could have offered us any medical help. I didn't have any other choice."
"Thank you for saving my life, Fräulein Gerber. Are you associated with the armed forces?"
"No, I'm a nurse. Well, I was a nurse."
The man tried to move his legs, his face twisted in agony, and she stepped forward again, right by his bedside now.
"Lie back down, Herr Graf."
It felt ridiculous to be using a name she knew wasn't real.
"I know you're in great discomfort."
She looked around for the aspirin pills. They weren't going to do anything more than temper his pain, but any kind of relief would help him sleep again. They were on the bedside table, which she'd shoved out of the way to reveal the floorboards, and now his eyes went down to the gaping hole she'd created. "What is going on here? What are you planning on doing?"
"Just some repairs,"
Franka said.
"Nothing to concern yourself with."
She took out 3 pills and offered them to him. He looked at them and then back into her eyes.
"They're just aspirin. They're not much, but they'll help until I can get something stronger."
She could see the pain in his eyes, and also the fear and confusion that he was working so hard to hide. He held out his hand, and she dropped the pills into his palm. She gave him water, and he swallowed the aspirin, gulping down the entire glass in seconds.
"Do you want more water?"
"Please." She hurried into the kitchen, glancing over at his rucksack on the floor of the living room as she passed. The guns were still inside. Her father's gun was in the drawer of the dresser table by the front door. When she returned, he was trying to get out of the bed, his face sweating and distorted in suffering.
"No, please,"
she said.
"Lie back down. You have nothing to worry about. I'm a friend."
She handed him the water. It was gone in seconds as before. She took the glass back. He was still upright on the bed. He folded his arms across his chest as she began to speak. He looked as if he was concentrating on each individual word she was saying.
Lie down. We've no way of moving you. The roads are closed, and both your legs are broken. We're stuck here together. We're going to have to trust one another.
Who are you? He said, rubbing the nape of his neck.
I'm from this area. I grew up in Freiburg. This was my family's summer home.
Are you here alone?
Apart from you. What were you doing out there in the snow? I have your parachute.
I can't talk about it. That's classified information. If I were to fall into Allied hands, it could be damaging to the war effort.
Well, you're still in the Fatherland. You're safe. The Allies are hundreds of miles away.
The man nodded, his eyes dropping to the floor.
You must be famished. I'll fetch you some food.
Yes, please.
My pleasure, Herr Graf.
She retreated to the kitchen. Her hands were shaking as she reached for the last can of soup in the cupboard. It was hard to know how to play it from here. Trying to out him from his charade could be downright dangerous, but she had to let him know that he could trust her.
Trust takes time,
she whispered.
This isn't going to happen tonight.
She went back to him as the soup warmed on the stove. He flinched as she walked in.
Everything all right?
Yes, thank you. It's just that the pain in my legs is quite intense.
I understand. I'm sorry about that. I'm going to try to get more painkillers for you tomorrow.
He didn't answer.
I have your boots, but I was forced to cut the pants off your legs. I also have your backpack. I saw that you had clothes in there.
He nodded, seemingly unsure of what to say. Thank you for taking care of me, he answered after a few seconds. His eyes drifted toward the window and then back to her.
I set the bones in your legs, but I'm afraid we're going to need plaster casts to make sure they heal correctly.
Yes, thank you, Fräulein Gerber. Whatever you think is best. His eyes were glazing over, and he fell back on the bed.
I'll be right back,
she said. The soup was ready, and she poured it into a bowl for him. He returned to the bedroom. He was lying down on the bed, staring at the ceiling. He sat up as she placed the tray in front of him. He devoured the soup even more quickly than she had earlier. She took the tray, wishing she had bread to give him.
You need to rest now.
I have some more questions for you.
Questions can wait.
Have you spoken to anyone else about my being here? Anyone at all?
I haven't spoken to another soul in days. Not since before I found you. We've no telephone here, as I said. There isn't even a postal service. I'd have to go into town to get any letters, if anyone knew I was up here. But they don't. We're alone.
She leaned forward.
I brought you back here so you could get better.
I'm grateful for that. But it's important that I be on my way as soon as possible.
You're not going anywhere on those legs for several weeks. Once the roads open up again, we can see about bringing you back to town. But until then, you're stuck here with me. You need to accept that and also realize that you can trust me. I'm here to make sure you get better.
I'm thankful, Fräulein. He nodded to her, but there was little joy or true appreciation in his words. It was as if he were reading off a script.
Think nothing of it. I could hardly leave you out there to freeze to death, now could I? The important thing now is that you rest.
Even her own words were wooden. It was as if they were two bad actors performing a play. The man nodded and lay back down, the pain evident on his face. Franco reached for the candle on the bedside table and extinguished it between two wetted fingers. She closed the door behind her, drained from the masquerade. She turned the lock once more, aware that he must have heard her do it. The man didn't protest. The fire in the living room was dying, so she added more wood, standing back once more to watch it blaze up. She felt like she was alone in a cage with a wounded animal, and unsure of anything it might do. His broken legs were her only guarantee of safety. As long as he couldn't move from that bed, he couldn't hurt her, especially without his guns. It was paramount that he understood that she meant him no harm, but also that she was in charge. She would not be subject to the whims of any bully, be they a Nazi or an Allied soldier. She would keep him here, safe from the Gestapo. That would be her final act of defiance against them, before she joined Hans and the others. Her entire body ached now, crying out for sleep. She went to her bedroom. Usually, she would have left the door open to collect some of the warmth from the living room, but she closed the door behind her. She went to the window. It was a calm, clear night, and the stars outside shone like light through pinpricks in black velvet. The weather tomorrow would likely be good enough for her to go into town. The trails would be clear. It was the type of trip she might have relished 10 years ago. That seemed like a different world. She'd accumulated so many scars since then. Franca picked a hot water bottle out of the closet, the memories of her youth coming at the mere sight of it. Nights cuddled up under blankets, her eyes drifting shut as her mother sang her to sleep. She had never meant to stay here this long. There were too many ghosts. But now she had little choice. Leaving the cabin would mean leaving him and giving the Gestapo their victory. She took the hot water bottle out to the kitchen and poured the water in once it had heated. It felt good in her hands, like it was giving life back to her. She hugged it, feeling the warmth in her chest, before returning to the bedroom. Could he really be German? Why would he have said those English words in his sleep? Perhaps this was all simpler than she'd made out, and she could drop him off at the local hospital when the roads cleared in a few days. Maybe she'd misheard him talking in his sleep. She didn't speak English, and had only heard a few words spoken in front of her. Perhaps he hadn't said anything at all. Perhaps he really was Hauptmann Werner Graf of the Luftwaffe. Franca felt her heart drop at the thought that he wasn't who she thought he was, that he was one of them. Was he a Luftwaffe flyer? She had seen the propaganda films that showed foreigners coming to join the glorious German Reich. It seemed unlikely. If he was Luftwaffe, she would hand him over to the authorities as soon as he came to, and that would be that. The bedroom went black as she blew out the oil lamp at her bedside. No, he had said those English words. She had heard them. She still could hear them, could still sound them out on her tongue. He wasn't Hauptmann Werner Graf of the Luftwaffe. Why had he been lying in the snow in the mountains of the Black Forest? He couldn't have been there for more than a few minutes when she'd found him, otherwise she would have come upon a corpse. If he was a spy or a prisoner of war, the penalty for helping him would be death. She could handle that. The National Socialists couldn't take anything more from her now. Not when she had nothing left for them to take. Franca turned over in the bed, pulling the thick blankets up to her chin, so that only her face was exposed. Beneath the bed covers was the only warm place in the house, apart from the fire. The man only had one blanket, and the hole she'd made in the floor would let in a draft. She got out of bed, taking the key to the man's bedroom door. She put on a nightgown and a coat over that before tiptoeing away. The house was still. She unlocked the door, put a hand on the door handle, and knocked with her other hand as she opened it.
"Hello?"
she whispered.
"Are you awake, Herr Graf?"
He was lying in the bed, but she could see that his eyes were open. For For a horrible second she thought he might have been dead, but soon he turned his head to her. I am awake, Fräulein.
Are you warm enough?
I'm fine, thank you. She didn't take his word for it. It was colder in his room than hers, and he didn't have as many blankets. She'd left the curtains open, and the light of the moon was streaming in. The features of his face were visible in the half-light. She took his hand. She hadn't planned on touching him, just wanted to see how cold he was. His eyes came to hers.
You're freezing,
she said.
Why didn't you ask me for another blanket?
I don't want to cause you any more trouble.
Nonsense. There's no use suffering when there are more blankets in the closet.
She let go of his hand and opened the closet. She took out a thick blanket and spread it over him.
This will keep you warm.
He was staring at her, and she stepped back.
I'm going into town tomorrow. The roads will be closed, but we need food, and I can't bear the thought of the pain you must be in.
She paused for an answer that didn't come.
It's obvious that I can't bring you in with me, but if you'd like, I can report your presence here to the local Gestapo.
It was her turn to stare at him now. That wouldn't be necessary, Fräulein. The local police are not of concern to me. As I mentioned previously, I'm handling some sensitive matters on behalf of the war effort right now. Alerting anyone to my presence here wouldn't be prudent at this time.
So, you don't want me to report that you're here to anyone? They could tell the Luftwaffe, your superior officer, who sent you up in that airplane.
Really, there's no need. I'll leave you as soon as the roads are clear. Until then, I'll be your grateful guest. Franco wondered if he knew how long his legs were going to take to heal, or if he was being deliberately ignorant. She was certain of one thing, however. He wasn't an English-speaking Luftwaffe pilot.
As you wish.
She turned to leave. Fräulein, how did you get me here?
I dragged you on a sled.
You dragged me back here unconscious. His eyes were wide in the darkness. He held his hands together in front of him as if he were praying. You are a truly remarkable person. I am forever in your debt.
You need to sleep now. Is there anything else you need?
Chamber pot, perhaps? Just in case.
Of course,
she answered, and went to the kitchen. She found a basin that would do the job and brought it back to him. He accepted it with a smile and thanked her once more. Franca closed the door behind her, turning the key in the lock. She determined not to use the name Werner Graf anymore. Saying it out loud demeaned them both. Franca awoke with the dawn. The night had brought a deeper sleep than she'd enjoyed for many months. The man's presence in the house had in some way blunted the memories that found her in the dark. The memories were always worse at night, and sleeping alone had become torture. There was comfort to be drawn from his presence here, and she felt it. She had already done so much for him, and he for her. He was the first thing that came to her mind as she opened her eyes. She wondered if he'd slept, and if he was in pain. She wondered if his bones were still set properly with the splint she'd made, and when, if ever, she'd learn the truth about him. The floor felt like ice, and she searched for her slippers, then slid her feet into them before venturing to the window. Pushing back the curtains revealed the winter sun in a cloudless, cobalt-blue sky. The snow was as it had been the night before. Doubts crept in. Did she really have to make this trip into town today? Could she wait? They had little food left, and she couldn't leave him lying in misery until the roads opened back up. Who knew when that would be? The roads up here could be closed for weeks at a time, although that was before the brutal efficiency of the Nazis. It was decided then. She would go into town today. She would go all the way into Freiburg. She would find the supplies she needed in the city, and no one was looking for her. She had no one to hide from. Franca went to his room and put her ear against the door. There was no noise from inside, so she drew back and went to the kitchen. The skis were still against the wall where she'd left them the night before. 10 miles was a ridiculous distance to attempt on skis, particularly considering her lack of practice these past few years. It was less than 2 to the main road into Freiburg, and she was confident in her ability to hitch a ride into town from there. She restocked the fireplaces in both the living room and the kitchen. The fires would be long extinguished by the time she returned, but would provide some warmth while she was gone. It had only been a few days since she'd been in Freiburg, but it seemed like years ago. She was a different person now. Those few days she'd spent in the city the week before were a blur. She closed her eyes, trying to forget. Franca unlocked the door to the man's room, listening for any noise before pushing it open. The room was dark, the curtains still closed. The hole in the floor remained. The man was lying asleep on the bed. He didn't seem like he'd moved since last night. She wondered if she should wake him, but then decided against it. She went to the desk in the living room and took a piece of paper and a pen.
"I'm going into town for the supplies we spoke about last night. I shouldn't be more than a few hours. Please stay in bed until I get back. Franca Gerber."
She wondered if she should have signed it Fräulein Gerber, but didn't want to bother writing the note all over again. He was still asleep when she returned to his room. What if this man was a prisoner of war? What then? Could she keep him up here for the remainder of the war? With the Allied landings in Italy a few months before, and the calamity of Stalingrad, the eventual defeat of the Reich finally seemed possible. But it wasn't close. The National Socialists still maintained an iron grip on most of Europe, not to mention Germany herself. Could she hide him up here for months, or even years?
"One thing at a time, Franca,"
she whispered.
"Get the man some painkillers, and some food to keep you both alive. Then worry about what comes next."
She placed the note and a glass of water on the bedside table. The bottle of aspirin was empty, the last of them taken in the night. The full weight of his pain was lying in wait for him as soon as he awoke. She closed her eyes as she took the empty bottle in her hand, letting a breath out through her nostrils. There was nothing more to be done. Franca locked the door behind her. The bright sunlight through the windows hadn't lulled her into any false hopes of warmth, and she put on her winter coat, hat, and gloves. She slipped her arms into her backpack, took the skis, and stepped out into the morning. Her sunglasses shielded her eyes from the burning sun. She slipped her feet into the skis, which still fit perfectly. Having them on felt like stepping into the past. The horizon was clear, broken only by the carpet of snow-peaked trees climbing the surrounding hills. The snow was flawless, innocent white, and would have lent a beauty to any landscape, let alone one as inherently spectacular as this. When was the last time she'd truly observed it? Had the darkness that had overtaken her obscured all else? She picked up speed, feeling a giddiness she thought she'd lost. The cabin faded into the distance. The ground hurtled toward him, the rushing of the air rendering all his senses useless. He reached for a parachute that wasn't there. The ground below him stopped, changed into the field behind his parents' house. He was suddenly on the ground, rolling in the softness of the grass, and as he tried to move, the pain struck. He shook awake to the sound of the front door closing. He bit down on his lip, balling his fists together as a tsunami of agony rolled over him. He struggled against it, taking a deep breath in through his nose. He opened his eyes again. Several minutes had passed, and his brow was damp with sweat. He saw the note on the table. Questions came faster than he could process them. His mind was wobbly, charred at the edges by pain. Who was this person? Was this some Gestapo plot to gain his confidence, to get him to reveal the true nature of his mission? The woman had said they were 10 miles outside Freiburg. He tried to remember exactly where that was and how far it was to his target. The Black Forest. He had landed in the Black Forest. They must have seen his parachute. The woman was a Gestapo agent. How could she have gotten him back here by herself? It didn't seem possible. She must have had help. Her story didn't check out. Her face appeared in his mind. She was pretty as a pearl-handled dagger. He checked his torso for wounds. His head ached, but apart from that, and of course his legs, he seemed okay. She must have gone for help. They'd probably be here in minutes. He reached down to touch the wooden splints along his legs. They seemed flimsy enough to confine him to his bed, but perhaps that was her plan. He was wearing pajamas, his backpack was missing, and his Luftwaffe uniform was thrown into the corner of the room. He propped himself up in the bed, trying to peer out the window through a chink in the curtains. He saw nothing but white. He needed a plan. Step one, get out of here. But how? The bed had been pushed all the way to one side of the bedroom. The window was about 8 feet away across the room, but might as well have been a mile. He took another sip of water before the hard part. The avalanche of pain that struck him as his legs dipped down the side of the bed was like nothing he'd ever experienced. He had to cover his mouth to stifle his own screams. It was cold in the room, but he could feel slick sweat on his back. He lay back and took a few ragged breaths. The house was quiet. A cuckoo clock sounded, the bell chiming 9 times. The noise brought him back into the moment, and he found the strength to sit up once more. Gently, he continued lowering his legs down the edge of the bed, carrying the weight of his body in his arms and pushing out deep breaths through pursed lips.
"Control the pain," he said in German.
He made sure he did. Any slip now would be fatal.
"Maintain your cover. You can do this."
His useless legs dangled off the side of the bed, and he was sitting now facing the window. He looked down at the missing floorboards that the young woman had pried up. What had she been doing? Was she trying to make it as hard as possible for him to get to the window? He surveyed the room. There was nothing between him and the window, nothing to prop himself up on once he got there. Perhaps crawling to the door might be the better option. He twisted his body around toward the doorway and let himself drop to the floor. He brought his hand down. Pain burned through him, but he gritted his teeth, taking as much weight as he could on the palm of his hand. He used his arms to pull himself along, dragging his legs behind him as he made it around to the door. He reached up to the handle. It was locked, but then he'd known that already. It took him 2 endless minutes to drag his broken body to where she'd tossed his Luftwaffe blazer. He smiled as he reached into the breast pocket for the paper clips he'd put there after his final briefing. The keyhole was set in a tarnished plate on the wooden door. He tried to peer through, but could only make out the glow of the fire burning. Picking locks hadn't been a specific part of his training. It was more of an extracurricular lesson his instructor had taught him. And he had excelled at it. He propped himself up, one hand on the knob, the other pushing the bent pin into the keyhole to turn over the tumbler. He missed it the first time. Seconds later, he heard the click as the tumbler came off. With a turn of the knob, the door fell open. The fire blazed. A stack of wood stood beside it, and above sat a mantelpiece with porcelain trinkets and a radio. A spot of wallpaper was less faded than the rest, signifying a missing picture. As he looked around the room, he realized that several pictures had been taken down. An empty rocking chair lay still beside the fire, with an old threadbare couch alongside it. The entrance to the kitchen was on his left, and the flickering light told of another fire she'd set in there. His backpack was sitting in the corner next to a bookshelf, and he wondered why she hadn't tried to hide it. Maybe there was no reason to hide it, if the Gestapo men were probably on their way here right now. The cabin was silent. No sounds at all, apart from the popping wood in the fireplace. He dragged himself over to his backpack on his forearms, reached into it, and pulled out a change of clothes, maps, and a flashlight. Both his pistols were gone, but he didn't waste time wondering where she'd stashed them. Instead, he sat up against the wall and reached back inside. His papers were intact. His Luftwaffe paybook, his leave papers, and his travel orders were all properly rubber-stamped, signed, and countersigned. And in front of him, not 30 feet away, was the front door. It took Franke 30 glorious minutes to reach the bottom of the valley and the main road into town. It had been cleared enough to let cars through, with the snow piled up at the side of the road on either side.
National Socialist efficiency,
she mumbled to herself. 5 minutes passed before a truck stopped to pick her up. A Wehrmacht soldier waved her to hop on board as he ground to a snowy halt. Franke stiffened, but had little choice now. It might look even more suspicious if she didn't take the ride. She tucked her skis under her arm and tramped up toward the door the soldier had left open for her.
"Good day, Fräulein," the soldier said with a smile. "Climb on board. I'm going all the way to Freiburg."
"That would be wonderful. Thank you."
She climbed into the passenger seat, doing her best to return the soldier's smile as she closed the door behind her. He was young, no older than 22, even younger than she was.
"What brings you into town on a day like this?"
"A shopping trip. I didn't expect this weather. We're snowed in and running a little low on supplies."
He glanced across at her longer than was comfortable, and the truck veered toward the curb before he righted it. She decided not to comment on the young soldier's driving skills.
"I haven't used these skis in years. I'm glad you picked me up."
"My pleasure, Fräulein."
She did her best to humor him as he talked and talked all the way into town. She told him nothing about herself, deflecting every question. It was a skill she'd honed over the years. She had it down to a fine art. The snow-covered hills around the city came into view first, followed by the roofs and spires, coated with white. From a distance, Freiburg looked like any medieval town in Europe. However, like everywhere else in Germany, Freiburg had changed under National Socialism. The Allied bombers hadn't rained destruction upon Freiburg like they had upon Hamburg, Kassel, or Dresden. Indeed, there had been only a few minor bombing raids on the city, but somehow that made the loss of her father even more severe. What had been the point of that raid in October? She wondered if the pilot or the bombardier ever thought about who they were killing when they dropped the bomb on her father's apartment block as he slept. Were they even aware that they'd killed civilians? Would they even care? Somehow, she doubted it. She felt her body tensing. They would never know the kind, gentle man they'd taken from her. The news of her father's death came via letter, and the warden had refused her appeal to go to the funeral on the grounds that "traitors to the Reich should not be shown undue compassion." It was only after she was released from prison that she was able to visit his grave, to utter faint, final goodbyes. The sight of the soldiers manning the checkpoint on the road into town brought everything back into sharp focus. The escape she'd enjoyed in the cabin was not to be found here. The chokehold that the National Socialists had on the citizenry of Germany was plain to see. Free movement or unsanctioned travel were relics of the past. Franca handed over the packet of papers she was required to produce on demand, sometimes several times a day. The sentry examined them as she sat in silence.
"On and pass?" he asked.
Franca nodded and reached into her pocket for her Arnon pass, a certificate of her Aryan ancestry. The sentry took a glance at it and handed it back with a nod. She hid her shame with a smile. The old joke Hans used to tell about the Aryan lies came back to her.
"What is an Aryan?"
he would ask the group.
"Blonde like Hitler,"
who had dark hair.
"Tall like Goebbels,"
someone else would say. Goebbels was 5'5".
"A perfect athletic specimen like Goering,"
who was a disgusting fat slug. Jokes had landed many people in jail. The Nazis displayed little good humor. Everything derogatory was censured and carried the threat of jail, or worse, no matter how funny the joke was. The sentry motioned the truck onward. Franca deflected the soldier's offer of a drink that night with the excuse of having a boyfriend on the Russian front. She jumped out in the center of town. Nazi flags rippled in the breeze. Hitler had explained the reasoning behind the various parts of the flag in the book he'd written during his time in jail, which Franca, and all the other kids, had been required to study in school like a religious catechism, a set of rules for life. The red background represented the social idea of the movement. The white circle in the middle spoke of the purity of its nationalistic goals, and the black swastika denoted the racial superiority of the Aryan race. The Aryans were a made-up race of blonde supermen, which the Nazis had convinced the German people they belonged to. She was the perfect Aryan specimen herself, tall, athletic, blonde, and with piercing blue eyes she had come to be almost ashamed of. The compliments she'd received on her perfect Aryan looks were flattering when she was a teenager. Now she resented them. A few hundred yards away, the Christmas market was bustling in the shade of the Freiburg Minster, the medieval Gothic cathedral that dominated the center of town. The cathedral was one of the few places of Catholic worship left, but only as a symbol of the religious freedoms that Hitler had promised when he first came to power. There was no mass. The local priest had been sent to a concentration camp years ago. The Protestant churches were still open, but years earlier they had been merged to form the National Reich Church to ensure that worship was controlled, and that the head of the Protestant church in Germany was both a member of the Nazi Party and an Aryan. Church members called themselves German Christians, with the swastika on their chests and the cross in their hearts. The National Socialists still allowed Christmas, but its future existence was far from assured. Anything that swayed belief from the Nazi cause was a threat. Franca kept her eyes on the pavement as she shuffled along, her skis under her arm, her rucksack on her back. Several soldiers in uniform brushed past her, laughing and joking. One of them whistled at her, but her eyes didn't waver from the grey-white slush on the cobbled pavement. She wondered if she would meet anyone she knew, and if she did, would they have heard about her? Would they shun her as a traitor? She hoped not to find out. A bell rang over the pharmacy door as she pushed her way inside. She kept her eyes to the floor as she made her way to the opiates. The tiny bottles of heroin were the first that caught her eye, but she moved on to the morphine. She bought enough for a few days, along with the syringes she would need to administer it. She took aspirin, plaster of Paris, gauze, and nylon socks to fit over the man's legs, and brought them to the counter. The pharmacist, a middle-aged man with a thick grey moustache, peered at her over his glasses with suspicious eyes. Franca noted the Nazi pin on his white coat.
"My brother,"
she smiled.
"He broke his legs tobogganing last night, and we're snowed in."
"Quite the predicament," the pharmacist said. Are you going to make up the cast yourself?
I'm a nurse. I'm well able to do it.
He's a lucky boy.
I don't know if you could call someone with two broken legs a lucky boy, but I suppose you might be right.
The pharmacist smiled and handed her the brown paper bag. Franca bade him goodbye and edged out of the store, trying to look as casual as possible. Inside, she felt like she was about to vomit. The air was fresh against her clammy skin, and a light snow was beginning. She only had to get the food before leaving. She missed the solitude of the cabin. These streets in this beautiful town had been perverted, twisted by the all-encompassing Nazi ideology that made it impossible to live a rewarding life, particularly for a woman. No woman was allowed to be a doctor, lawyer, civil servant, or judge. Juries were to be made up only of men. Women could not be trusted to make decisions. They were thought too susceptible to being controlled by their emotions. Women weren't allowed to vote either. But what good was a vote anyway? All parties other than the National Socialists had been made illegal. German women were forbidden to wear makeup, or to color or perm their hair. Instead, the three K's were drummed into girls from an early age. Kinder, children, Kirche, church, and Küche, kitchen. She could still remember her League of German Girls troop leaders urging them to forget about the ridiculous notion of a self-satisfying career. It was more important to stay home and bear strong sons that could one day serve the Reich. That was the role a woman had to play in modern Germany. And many of the girls she had known in her youth had adapted to it. Some had received the Mother's Cross, a medal the Nazis gave out to mothers who had more than five healthy Aryan children. Hilde Speigel, a girl she had been in the League of German Girls with, had already received the ultimate honor, the gold Mother's Cross, for the eight children she had by the age of 27. Remembrances of Franka's old life swarmed like locusts around her head. Every building she walked by conjured a new memory. The site of the apartment her father had lived in for the last 5 years of his life was only blocks away, and she felt her footsteps slowing as she neared it. She thought of the man in the cabin. He was one of them, one of the allies who'd perpetrated that crime. She longed for the luxury of oblivion. She arrived at the general store. The German people were feeling the ravages of the war. The early days of the war had seen almost as much plenty in the stores as before the battles had started. But rationing began in earnest in the spring of 1942, and many commonly used items were now considered a luxury. The smell of fresh bread made her empty stomach rumble. She found a loaf, as well as some cheese and dried meats. It was uphill most of the way home, so she tried to avoid heavier goods like the canned soups that had kept for so long in the cabin. When she had gotten as much food as her rationing card allowed, she made for the counter to use some of her father's inheritance money to pay. She remembered the lawyer as he'd read her the will. He knew that she'd spend time in jail, and although he didn't say it out loud, she suspected he knew why. The judgment was in his eyes. Franca made her way out onto the street. It was almost 2 o'clock now. There was no use trying to make it back to the cabin on an empty stomach. She had kept aside enough of her ration tickets to afford lunch, and she knew a place down the street. The café was bustling with loud chatter as she arrived. Smoke hung in the air. Several soldiers sat in the corner, laughing and drinking beer. Sitting as far away from them as she could, she ordered schnitzel and potatoes and a cup of café au lait. 5 minutes later, her food arrived. It was heavenly, and she barely stopped to breathe as she wolfed it down. The man at the table next to her got up from his seat, leaving his newspaper, something she could hide behind. She picked it up and held it to her face. It was full of stories glorifying the Führer and the brave soldiers fighting for Germany's future in Russia. She stopped reading after a few seconds and just let her eyes rest there. She was thinking about the trip back to the cabin, thinking about the man, when she heard a voice in front of her.
Franka Gerber?
She felt her chest contract as she lowered the newspaper. She saw the black uniform of the Gestapo before her eyes made their way up to the face of a man she had hoped she would never have to see again. Daniel Berkel. The man placed the maps, compass, spare clothes, and his identity papers back into the backpack, just as he'd found them. He was sitting up by the bookcase. The front door was about 30 feet away, but the back door was even closer. He could make out the white glow of sun on snow seeping underneath the door. He wasn't dressed to go outside, and escape would be impossible with his broken legs. The truth that his stubbornness had tried to fight became all too clear. Without his weapons, he was at Franka Gerber's mercy, whoever she happened to be. He was still wearing the pajamas she'd put him in, but what harm would looking out do? Perhaps she was telling the truth, and they were in the middle of the mountains. Perhaps not. He dragged himself along the floor. The hallway was gritty, and he could feel the particles of dirt under his palms as he crawled along. With his right hand, he reached up for the door handle, pushing up on his left elbow. He moved his body out of the way as he wrenched the door open. An ocean of white burned his eyes. The cold draft cut at his exposed chest, and he felt the pain in his legs like knives into his flesh. The door opened out onto an area for firewood. Snow-covered trees began just a few feet beyond.
Nothing to see. Damn.
He closed the door. He took a few seconds to regain his breath before crawling back into the living room. The fire was warm, and he lost a minute or two lying in front of it. What the hell was he going to do, even if they were close to the city? How was he going to get there with two broken legs? If he did make it there alive, which seemed so ridiculous as to be almost impossible, anyone who picked him up would bring him to the local hospital immediately. That would be the end, for him and the mission. More likely, he would die in the snow, as he undoubtedly would have if the woman hadn't brought him back here. Perhaps she was who she said she was. Perhaps she was a friend. What were the chances of being found by someone friendly in this country of fanatics? He had seen the newsreels of enormous crowds, cheering Hitler's every word, waving flags, beating on drums. The entire nation had seemingly been brainwashed into following the Nazi cause like a new religion. Why else would they do the things they did in the occupied territories? How else could they justify an organization as savage as the Gestapo? He remembered his instructor's words.
Trust no one.
He'd said that the only good German was a dead one. The recruits had laughed, but there was no doubting the veracity of his words. They all believed it, just as he himself did. The view behind the back door had told him nothing. He had to be sure. He began crawling toward the front. The cuckoo clock in the hallway by the front door struck 10 o'clock. He kept on, one arm and then another, ignoring the pain in his legs. He reached the door and turned the handle, opening it an inch before moving his body out of the way to open it fully. The glare of white came again, and he saw a Volkswagen covered in snow. He pitched himself up on his palms as high as he could. There was nothing but snow and trees as far as the eye could see. Not even a road. There was no sound. No other sign of life. It was true. They were alone up here. He closed the front door and started making his way back to the living area. He wanted to be in bed when she got back. Didn't want her to suspect that he'd been up and snooping around the house. He stopped at a hall table beneath the cuckoo clock. More out of a whim than anything else, he reached up to open the small table drawer. It opened, and he recognized the sound of sliding metal immediately. He reached in and pulled out a pistol. He would be ready, and if they did come, he was taking some of them with him.
"It's wonderful to see you. You look better than ever. How long has it been, Franca?"
Beckel said. Franca was staring at the death's head skull on his hat. He took the cap off and put it under his arm.
"Thank you. It's been years, Herr Beckel. 4 years?"
"I haven't seen you since you moved to Munich. Do you mind if I sit down for just a moment?"
He pulled out the chair opposite her.
"Of course not."
She had no choice in the matter.
"Please, call me Daniel. We shouldn't need to be so formal just because of my position. We're old friends, catching up, and that's all I want to do. Catch up. Do you mind if I smoke?"
He offered her a cigarette. She hadn't smoked for several years, but took one anyway. He lit her cigarette first, then his own. Puffs of white smoke filled the air between them. She sat back, hoping it might calm her nerves.
"What brings you back to Freiburg?" he continued.
"I came back to visit my father's grave, and for the reading of his will."
"Yes, of course. I saw his name on the list of dead from the last Allied bombing raid. I am sorry for your loss. Those animals don't care how many of our citizens they massacre. I long for the day when we might avenge the deaths of your father and the hundreds of thousands of German citizens murdered by the Allies."
Franca could feel her whole body shaking.
"As do I, Daniel."
Merkel seemed convinced.
"And I also wanted to express how sorry I was to hear about you."
He took a drag from the cigarette. Franca didn't know what to say, how to answer.
"I heard about what happened in Munich."
She wanted to ask how, but knew that he probably knew everything about everyone from Freiburg.
"It's a tragedy that you were brought under the influence of those despicable traitors to the Reich."
Her heart hardened. Hans was 100 times the man Daniel or any of his Nazi cronies would ever be. She sat still, focusing on controlling the terror below her calm surface.
"Thank you, Daniel."
"I'm so glad that the judge recognized the fact that, as a woman, you needed to be protected. Your good nature left you more susceptible to the horrific lies and propaganda that scum was spreading. I'm sorry that you went through that."
He took a drag on his cigarette before continuing.
"It must have been a horrible experience. I know it might be hard to recognize sometimes, but the National Socialists do want what's best for the German people."
Franca didn't react. She could tell by the earnest look on his face that he meant every word.
"I was lucky. That much is certain."
"Yes. I was glad to see that you didn't end up going to the guillotine, as those other traitors did. You still have a future ahead of you as a wife and mother, and one day you'll produce sons to serve the Reich."
Daniel finished his cigarette and stubbed it out in the ashtray on the table between them. Franca had taken about 3 drags from hers. He leaned forward.
"I know you've learned your lesson."
"Of course. I was foolish, led astray. I should have reported those swine, but I was frightened."
She took a deep breath in a vain attempt to douse the pain that saying those words brought. An elderly woman approached the table. Beckel stood up to greet her.
"Herr Beckel, it's so good to see you," she said.
"And you, Frau Gertsch, you look wonderful."
"I'm so thankful to you."
"Think nothing of it. It was my pleasure."
The old woman lifted up a bag.
"I have something for you and your family."
"Oh, no, I couldn't possibly accept."
"Take it. For your boys. It's for them. For all you've done for my family."
Beckel took the bag.
"Thank you. I'll be sure and let the boys know you were thinking of them this Christmas."
"Bless you, Herr Beckel,"
she said, backing away.
"Heil Hitler."
Heil Hitler, Beckel said, and sat back down. Excuse me, he said.